Turn back there to Romans chapter 10 and let's notice again what Paul says on the subject of the righteousness of God and the attitude of some to go about establishing their own righteousness. There are several things in that reading that particularly stand out. Paul said, "Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved." The heart's desire and prayer that Paul talks about is not anything that he didn't feel for every single lost soul, but there does seem to be a little bit of a sense of connection because these are his countrymen. He refers to them in another place as his brothers in the nation. The great concern that he has for souls reminds us of the fact that every single person has a soul. And a soul will be lost if that person does not join themselves to the will of God in the practice of God's righteousness. How concerned are we for the lost souls of people around us? And even more especially for the people that are close to us. "For I bear them witness," Paul says, "that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge." Their zeal was an admirable effort, if only it had been connected with knowledge. It was as though they had the idea that some surely share today, as long as I'm zealous for this, it'll make up for whatever I don't know. That's not the basis for our service to God. Paul said, "Oh, I bear them record, they have a zeal. Their zeal is admirable except for the fact that it's not connected to knowledge. For being ignorant of the righteousness of God and seeking to establish their own righteousness, they do not submit to God's righteousness." God's righteousness. We need to dig into that a little bit deeper. God's righteousness. They were ignorant of the righteousness of God and wanted to establish their own righteousness. They have not submitted themselves to God's righteousness. God's righteousness must be submitted to. We know that, don't we? We understand that well. And yet so many people around us think or believe that it doesn't really matter how we practice or what we practice. As long as we practice something, everything will be good. We must submit to God's righteousness. Submission, subjection is the only thing that works. You can look around you, not here in this building, but you can look around you in your life and you can begin to count off all of those around you who obviously have never submitted themselves to the righteousness of God. In our modern Christian society today, we have conditions that are not entirely unlike those in Paul's day, or even with the Pharisees with whom Jesus dealt in the text that we're going to look at in just a few minutes. Casual Christianity seems to be the desire of so many people, and we could even call it casual righteousness. Casual Christians are those who don't really want to follow the shepherd closely, even though they still want to be somewhat connected to the flock. They want the forgiveness that the cross of Christ brings, but they have no intention of ever picking up and carrying their own cross. They want warm and fuzzy Sunday mornings that make them feel good about themselves, but they really don't want anything to do with commitment to Jesus on Monday morning. These things sound familiar. I believe I've observed those kind of characteristics in the lives of so many people today, people that we see and work with and are around a big portion of our time. To sum it up, the majority of people around us today seem to want the crown, but they don't want anything at all to do with the cross. And it's a formula that does not, as they say, compute. There is no crown without adhering to the cross. Obviously, living according to God's righteousness is not something that's really easy to do. It's not a life of misery and suffering, as some might want you to believe, but it's certainly not without its hard and difficult moments from time to time. Obviously, some have faltered. Obviously, we all stumble from time to time. Some people may have gotten into it without really realizing what they were getting into or what it would take. Whatever our personal situation is right now, there never will be a better time to renew our zeal, a zeal according to knowledge, and redouble our efforts toward true righteousness. Turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 14. I'd like for us to read a few verses here this morning as we consider some events that take place on a Sabbath day when Jesus has been invited to a meal in the house of a prominent Pharisee. And the text here in Luke chapter 14, verses 1 through 14, reveals the fact that Jesus was under very close scrutiny. He was being watched. In his conversation with the people in this place, it's clear from the Lord's words that he's confronting a very popular notion that the Pharisees seem to have about righteousness. And those notions are just simply not true. From what Jesus says in this discussion, we understand clearly that he recognizes there are some problems in the lives of these men who are talking to him. Today, I think we could say that we're faced with somewhat the same situation. And it's sad to say so, but it would be true, I think, both in and out of the church. There are some false ideas that people have about being a Christian and serving God and what constitutes that. Wouldn't be possible for us in the time allotted this morning to discuss all of the errors and the mistaken notions and ideas that people have about what being a Christian is all about. But there are some things I want us to focus on that are suggested by Jesus' words here in this text. As we look at what the Lord told these people, I think we can learn at least three very important things about the righteousness of God. First of all, I think we have to acknowledge the fact that these men to whom the Lord was talking had their own notion of what righteousness was all about. They had their own private version, if you will. And they thought that their version was right. Why they didn't understand well that their version was not in harmony with God's version, I can't say. But obviously what they believe and practice is at odds with what God says. And generally speaking, as we read about these fellows here in Luke chapter 14, we typically aren't willing to cut them any slack, because it's obvious that they are not willing to comply with what God wants them to do. The question that needs to be dealt with, I suppose, is why is it any different today? Why is the matter of sincere and truthful and accurate righteousness, God's righteousness in our lives, why is that not viewed as a very specific thing? Why is it that so many religious people take this broad view of you do what you want to and I'll do what I want to and everything will be fine in the end? We're not willing to give that concession to the Pharisees in their practice. Why would we not insist that today the same principles of God's righteousness are true? The Pharisees obviously believed that they had their own version, and their version was good. Let's look at the first four verses here, or first six verses of Luke chapter 14. It happened that when he went into the house of one of the leaders of the Pharisees on the Sabbath to eat bread, they were watching him closely. I believe this is a setup. Maybe you'll agree with me as we get a little further into this. And there in front of him was a man suffering from dropsy. Jesus answered and spoke to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they kept silent. And he took hold of him and healed him and sent him away. And he said to them, "Which one of you, having a son or an ox fall into a well, will not immediately pull him out on a Sabbath day?" And they could make no reply to this. There's no getting around the fact that these guys had their own set of rules for the Sabbath. Now, God had given some very specific things that governed what people could do and could not do on the Sabbath day. There was a limitation as to how far you could travel. There was a limitation against working on the Sabbath. But those were not specific enough for the Pharisees, and they had devised their own set of rules. In fact, they said things like, "Well, on the Sabbath day, you shouldn't wear a heavy coat, because if it gets warm in the course of the day, and you have to take it off, and then you've got to carry it, and so you're carrying a burden on the Sabbath day, and that defiles the Sabbath." They said you couldn't tie a knot on the Sabbath day because that was work. You couldn't kill flies. You couldn't even kill a flea on the Sabbath day, according to the Pharisees. They had come up with all sorts of prohibitions that they wanted to enforce on everyone. But Jesus obviously isn't impressed with these guys and all of their rules and their contempt that they had for others. He says in Matthew 23, verse 4, about these particular people, the Pharisees, he said, they tie up heavy burdens and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move as much as a finger. I know some people like that. I know some people who want you to be right, but they're not worried about themselves being right. On this occasion, you'll notice Luke says they were watching him closely. The word in the original language here means to watch with sinister intent. I mean, let's just get right down to it. They were watching and waiting for an opportunity to catch Jesus in something wrong that he said or did, hoping to find a mistake. You'll also notice in verse 3, the New American Standard says, and Jesus answered and spoke to the lawyers and Pharisees. He answered and spoke to them. Some translations render that word, he responded. Let me ask you something. When you answer somebody, that pretty much means they've what? They've asked a question. They've brought up the subject. If you respond to someone, they've evidently said or done something that elicits a response. I didn't hear these guys ask Jesus anything, did you? But Jesus did. Jesus heard what they were thinking in their hearts. He heard the questions that they had. And so he preempts them with a question of his own about healing on the Sabbath. Now, this was an old argument for these guys. In fact, by this time that's recorded here in Luke chapter 14, Jesus has already healed in their presence on the Sabbath day at least 6 times before this. And it made them fighting mad every single time that he did it. And Jesus, upon receiving no answer from them, heals the man and sends him away. And then he challenged them again with a question that they had no answer to. Which of you, having a son or an ox that falls into a well, will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day? The fact is, every single one of them would have. But every single one of them seemingly would have told Jesus or you or me or anybody, you can't do that on the Sabbath day. They had their own definition of righteousness. Not only that, but they had no doubt that they were the perfect practitioners of righteousness. A little bit later in Luke chapter 18, verse 9, Jesus would say, these people thought they were righteous and viewed others with contempt. He's talking about the Pharisees. And today, a lot of people claiming to be Christians and more or less believe that they live lives of righteousness, but their righteousness is somewhat distant from the righteousness of God. We need to re-examine our lives and the definition of what serving God is. And we need to make sure that we've got the same definition that the Lord does. Because if we don't, there's going to be trouble somewhere. And I think you know where that will be. There's a second thing that comes to mind here. That is the fact that God's righteousness is not about giving ourselves a pat on the back. Listen to what verses 7 through 11 says. And he began speaking a parable to the invited guests when he noticed how they had been picking out the places of honor at the table, saying to them, "When you're invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor. For someone more distinguished than you may have been invited by him, and he who invited you both will come and say to you, 'Give your place to this man.' And then in disgrace you will proceed to occupy the last place. But when you're invited, go and recline at the last place, so that when the one who has invited you comes, he may say to you, 'Friend, move up higher.' Then you will have honor in the sight of all who are at the table with you. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." You know, that last phrase there in verse 11 is kind of the summary of how we are to treat ourselves as the Lord's disciples. Now, we talk a lot about how we're to treat others and how we're to treat God, but there is a specific way that we are to treat ourselves according to God's righteousness. We're to let God do the exalting. But there's something in us that just wants to move up. There's something in us that wants to reach out and grab that first place. We're geared to excel. Today's culture, undeniably, is constantly telling us that we need to reach up and claim the best for ourselves. There is something to be said for honest, sincere, and wholesome ambition. But when ambition exceeds humility, we've got a major problem. Against the advice of the world and against my human instincts, Jesus says that I should take for myself the lowest place. Not for the sake of pure self-punishment or abuse, but rather because that puts me in a position that is most available for God's use, and He will position me where He wants me accordingly. That's what James means in James chapter 4, verse 10, when he says, "Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and He will lift you up." The problem a lot of times is we've skipped over God's part and we've lifted ourselves up. And a lack of humility does not fit in with what God says righteousness is to be. Humility. That's one of the main ingredients to God's righteousness. Then in the third place, we learn here that God's righteousness involves being ready, seeking to serve others, not ourselves. Notice what we read in verses 12 through 14. And he also went on to say to the one who had invited him, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or your rich neighbors. Otherwise, they may also invite you in return, and that will be your repayment. But when you give a reception, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed, since they do not have the means to repay you. For you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. Religion in Jesus' day had actually come to resemble what we today might call office politics. Any office politics where you work? Some of you are saying, oh yeah, yeah, big time. In other words, a lot of what a lot of people do is geared toward making sure it leaves the door open for somebody to return a favor to us. Now, we need to be real careful with office politics, but we also need to understand very clearly that the Lord's message here is what we do is not ever to be geared toward what are we going to get out of this from these people. What we do is for others. Every little act among the worshipers of Jesus' day was done in view of what it could bring in terms of payback and return favors. Men were exalted by other men in return for being able to receive the praise or the exaltation back from them. Future considerations. Actually, I suppose it would be true to say that their religious practice had grown into a very disgusting system of do unto others so that they'll return the favor to you. I read a little bit a day or so ago about what is generally called pork barrel politics. And I discovered that there is an organization, it was no great surprise, but I discovered that there is an organization that keeps track of every bit of major legislation that is passed and then gives a list of every single line item that has been put in by individual politicians, hoping that nobody will read it through item by item, and this little line item brings a windfall to their state or their district or whatever. And then they give a total of the amount of money involved in that in every major appropriations bill that is passed. Honestly, it was sickening. It turned my stomach. It made me so disgusted with some of our nation's leaders, so-called. I finally just gave it up. I thought maybe it's one of those occasions where the less I know about it, the better off I am. Because obviously I don't have much control over that situation. In a way, that situation kind of illustrates what religion among the Pharisees had degenerated to in Jesus' day. Making sure that everything they did would have a future consideration from someone coming back. The true disciple today must be in possession of that genuine compassion that Jesus says must calls us to give preference to one another in honor, Romans 12:10. And with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves, Philippians 2, verse 3. We need to be known as the kind of people who are concerned for others, regardless of whether or not they would ever be in a position to do something back for us. True discipleship is all about getting involved. And if necessary, getting right down in the dirt with someone to help dig them out of their troubles. Because serving others is serving the Lord. What are we known for? The Pharisees obviously had a very clear reputation. We know all about them. What are we known for? What is our reputation? Paul says in Romans chapter 12, verses 14 through 17, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another, do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be conceited, repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. Next, in this text, Jesus goes right into the parable of the Great Supper, the feast. Tonight, I'd like for us to look at some things about that. But this morning, where do we stand on God's righteousness? It's not important to make sure the righteousness we have is something that we like. What's important is making sure that the righteousness that we practice is God's righteousness. And in the first 14 verses of this chapter, Jesus tells us what that's about. Have you obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ? Believing in Jesus as God's Son, repenting of your sins, confessing your faith, and being buried with Him in baptism to rise and walk in newness of life. If you've done that but have become unfaithful in your service to God, come back. Be restored. If you haven't done that, if you've never obeyed the gospel, there never will be a better time than today. And as we sing this song, if you're subject to the Lord's invitation, we invite you to come forward.